We have a wills and estate planning primer here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Planning for our last days or an emergency is uncomfortable to think about, uncomfortable to talk about, but it can also bring a sense of comfort. The term estate planning applies to more than privileged people. Even with modest assets, you need a written document specifying how assets will be divided up upon your death. And most Americans lack such a document. Are you making your will now and need some help? Have you recently revised it? What was that process like? Who in your life has been meticulous about their will or advance directives? What can we learn from them? It's 800-642-1234. Let's talk about it. Chantel Ringy is partner at Hill Glowacki. It's a Madison law firm working in the area of estate planning, elder law, and special needs planning. Chantel, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you. Good morning.
Well, let's start with the most basic but key question here. What is a last will and testament?
We get that a lot. A lot of people call here and they say, I just need a simple will.
Simple? Is that an oxymoron? Is any will simple?
Trust me, I come from the... My general preference is to keep things as simple as possible, which I find is oftentimes my client's preference as well. But what is a will? So in Wisconsin, a will must be written, as I think you mentioned. In almost every case, it's going to be expected that your wishes be documented in a writing, which you have signed, executed, as we say, before two witnesses. And hopefully those two witnesses are not beneficiaries, right? Hopefully they're disinterested. But a will basically says what you might think it says. It says, to the extent I have property when I die, that's going to pass by probate, and we can talk about what that means. I want it to pass thus and thus. So to these persons or to these charities. And then further, your will would say who you want to sort of carry out those instructions. In Wisconsin, we call that person your personal representative, and hopefully a backup is named to your first choice. And then a will in Wisconsin, too, is the only place where you can nominate a legal guardian for any minor children you may leave if neither parent is able to serve in that role. So that's another very important use for a will. That might be the most important. If you don't have a lot of, if you don't have a large estate, but you have minor children, that might be the most important reason to have an estate plan.
Right. Establishing a guardian for children is a huge thing, I would imagine.
Yeah. And that can be the toughest thing, just speaking from my own personal experience. Mm-hmm. Because, of course, nobody's going to do as good of a job as you, right? Mm. but that is extremely important, because otherwise, especially to the extent there may be different members of the family branches who hold different views as to who should be the successor guardian, last thing you want is for your children to be involved in some sort of a dispute.
We're talking with attorney Chantel Ringy, who works in the area of estate and special needs planning. We're spending the hour on last wills and testaments, taking your questions. Did a loved one pass and not have a will in place? How did that affect your family? How did that affect family dynamics? Do you know someone who did a model job planning for their estate before they passed? Share it with us, 800-642-1234. There's this sentiment that, even if I do the right thing and I have a will, I have the document, that the document might not hold up with the state. Can you help us with that reasoning?
There really aren't that many occasions when we see wills declared invalid, at least not in my experience. If they're properly executed in the form that I described, and assuming... this isn't always the case, right? But assuming there isn't a lot of fighting over whether or not, mom had, as we say, testamentary capacity when she signed her will.
And that means that you're in a solid state of mind?
Yeah, sound mind.
Sound mind, okay.
Right, so you have to have some understanding generally of what your assets are. You know, you don't need to know the balance in your investment account, but you need to have some idea of what your assets are. And to have testamentary capacity, you need to also be able to formulate a desire for and be able to identify who your beneficiaries are. So as long as you have those things, even if it's in a lucid moment, right? But that's the job of the attorney, to sit down with their client and assess whether they have testamentary capacity. So assuming that's not in question, then generally speaking, the will is going to be upheld.
How has that changed? I know you say, you know, sitting down with an attorney. How has COVID affected this process and being able to get these documents in place?
That's a really good question. As you might imagine, I think some people, especially early on, were very pensive about coming into a lawyer's office, even more so than usual. and so, you know, I heard of other firms doing things like, in the warmer months at least, pitching a tent in their parking lot and doing drive-by kind of, you know, your client's scheduled at this time, they'll arrive, they'll pull up to the tent, and you'll do your execution of the documents that way. Unfortunately, in Wisconsin, we cannot notarize estate planning documents remotely. We can't witness estate planning documents remotely, meaning even via something like Zoom, you can't, as a witness to someone signing, say, I was in the presence, or the testator or testatrix was in my presence when they signed, which is something that the statutes require. And I know there have been a couple of petitions to the Supreme Court, the state Supreme Court, during the pandemic to try to request some flexibility there.
Yeah, it's part of also Governor Evers' new bill as well, to have some flexibility for notaries to do it virtually.
Yeah, you know, I think that there, ideally, there should be some room to, on the one hand, you know, still maintain the formality of the process, because there's a reason why it's a formal process to sign a will, because individuals can be and sometimes are coerced into creating an estate plan that maybe they don't prefer. But it's in those cases that we want to make sure that someone really is assessing their willingness and their understanding and their capacity.
How should someone approach finding a lawyer or to complete a will, or whether to do it online through an online template? What are some deciding factors?
Yeah, good question. Well, I think word of mouth is best. You know, if you have a friend who's recently completed an estate plan, and if they had a good experience, talk to them and find out what they liked. Otherwise, call around, you know, do some. I'm surprised sometimes how many people say they found us through a Google search when they call. And so call around, get a sense for how the firm operates. You know, what's the general procedure to create your plan, and how do they bill? And does their rate seem competitive based on what you're hearing from other firms, or maybe disproportionately high? There are some online tools. I don't use them, right? And I don't often recommend that folks go that route. Not that they can't be value added. They could be a good starting place. And there certainly are a lot of statutory forms that are very helpful, and we can talk about those.
Let's pause there with Attorney Chantel Ringy, our guide to writing a will, making sure it's sound. What do you want to know about estate planning? What issues are you running into as you talk with loved ones and take stock of your life? 800-642-1234, back on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, we're discussing the written document that reflects your wishes when you pass. It's The Morning Show, all about wills and estate planning. I'm Kate Archer. Ken, thanks for being here. For parents, the chance to name guardians for your kids may be the single most compelling reason to make a will. That's the case for me. Did you use an online template or website to keep your costs down? How did that work? What special circumstances do you want to ask about in making your will? Have you named an executor or personal representative, the term here in Wisconsin? Join in 800-642-1234. Attorney Chantel Ringy is our guide to wills, and she stays with us for the hour. Let's bring in Ron, who is joining us from Eastern Wisconsin. Hi, Ron. What's your question?
Good morning. Thanks. What factors should be considered when estate planning to determine if one should have a will or a trust?
Oh, great question.
Yeah, that is a good question. So, you know, usually if you have a trust-based plan, you also have a sort of abbreviated will. But in that case, the trust generally contains most of the provisions that say how you want your property to be distributed. And the reason folks might create a trust, and the most common type of estate planning trust, I would say, is a revocable trust, sometimes called a revocable living trust. And the primary reason you might be interested in that is because it will, generally speaking, allow your assets to pass without the need for probate when you pass. And so the question really is, do I want to avoid probate? And probate is, it's the court-supervised administration of your assets and the transfer of your assets when you die. So, and the key being that it's court supervised. So you need to, your loved one would have to, or whoever's administering your affairs when you pass away, if you have a probate, would need to petition the court in the county where you passed, and essentially request to be appointed as your personal representative. And so if you have a will, then you've got that person nominated, and that usually makes that process easier for them. But there's either a, in Dane County, at least, the court will schedule a hearing on your petition, that person's petition to be appointed, unless there are waivers from your heirs at law, who are persons who are determined by statute to be, to have an interest in your estate, whether, at least at the outset, your estate plan might not provide for them, but the law says they have an interest at the outset. So, you know, usually there's some need to communicate with other people and get permission, get that waiver for them to be appointed without the need for a hearing. A lot of people just don't like the idea that they're going to have to attend a court hearing, right? Mm-hmm. And then subsequent the appointment, there are a host of other required filings that the probate court is going to expect from your personal representative. And so you need, they need to make sure that they diligently sort of tick through those requirements before the court is going to be allowed or going to permit them to distribute the estate and close it out. That in a nutshell is probate. And it tends to take usually months, several months.
Yeah, I've been through probate, and it's a lot of time, a lot of documents, and it's quite costly.
Yeah, I mean, because a lot of times you're going to want some advice from an attorney along the way to make sure you're handling things properly, particularly, you know, if your beneficiaries are going to expect an accounting, which the court is going to presume you're going to provide them unless, again, they waive that requirement. So you want to make sure that you've got your ducks in a row so that the information that you're providing to the beneficiaries about what you started with, what went out, what came in, and what you ultimately distributed, so that those numbers kind of all true up in the end. And so, you know, a revocable trust, on the other hand, it's not that your trustee, who's the person who would sort of be taking the reins when you pass away, or if you become incapacitated even, it's not that your trustee doesn't have work to do. They still do. You know, they still have to corral your assets, or at least identify what all they're dealing with, pay your final expenses and taxes and so forth, and then make those distributions and usually an accounting of some sort to the trust beneficiaries. So there's still some administration when you have a revocable trust. It's just outside of the purview of your county probate court. And so a lot of people like that.
What is the difference then with an irrevocable trust?
So an irrevocable trust, I guess there are kind of a couple of types that come to mind primarily. You may have an irrevocable trust that most often, if I'm drafting an irrevocable trust, it's because the individual who's the beneficiary of that trust is maybe receiving public benefits. And you don't want the assets going into the trust to be to jeopardize their continued financial eligibility for something like maybe long-term care Medicaid benefits or SSI benefits through Social Security. That's why most often I'm drafting an irrevocable trust.
I see.
So that's, you know, a type of estate planning that may come into play if you have a beneficiary who has special needs, and particularly a beneficiary who is receiving means-tested public benefits. Otherwise, irrevocable trust may, a second type that comes to mind is, and I don't draft these often myself, but if you wanted to sort of do Medicaid planning, like sort of Medicaid asset protection planning, and kind of put assets into an irrevocable trust so that they no longer belong to you and wait out sort of the divestment period for long-term care Medicaid, that's a whole different sort of type of planning. Very complicated, in my opinion, and slightly aggressive. I don't do that kind of planning, but that's kind of the other type of irrevocable trust. And of course, the distinction between revocable versus irrevocable is the creator's ability to freely say, I'm going to terminate this creation and just pull the assets back out of the trust. When it's irrevocable, the creator's ability to do that is much more restricted.
We are talking about making a will with Chantelle Ringy. She's an attorney in Madison. What do you want to know about making a will or about estate planning? What issues are you running into? 800-642-1234. Mark's joining us from Black River Falls this morning. Hi, Mark. What is your situation? What's your question?
First, I want to say thank you for being one of the most awesome hosts I listen to on a regular basis.
Thanks, Mark.
And second is, I didn't get the last name. I got the first name, Chantelle. I thank you for the topic. The issue I have and the question I'm having is, what is the definition of sound mind if a person is in a physical condition to where they've been advised to get a will made, they don't know the process? How does that person reach out and know they're doing the right thing? So a will that they write will not be contested. The reason I'm asking this is I'm a disabled veteran. I've got multiple spinal fractures, and I've also began falling down, and I've had lights out concussions where my head actually will hit either a pavement or whatever's around if I fall forward. I've been told by one doctor last year that I am one wrong fall, which can be permanently paralyzed being in a wheelchair. And then this year, because I'm still falling, I've been told I am one wrong fall away from being a permanent vegetable in a hospital bed.
Yeah, so really,
how do I go about writing a will with that known? I apologize, I'm incurring a stutter with my last concussion. Am I able to write a will for myself, or do I need to someone else to write a will for me?
Mark, thank you for that. Chantel?
You can write your own will. If you're planning to do that, though, I would at least ask an attorney to review that it's been properly executed. There are a lot of ways that you may sort of traps for the unwary, if you will. And there are a lot of ways to be unclear about your directions unintentionally. And so that's the reason why I say at the very least have an attorney review it. Otherwise, you know, I find that there are legal clinics, of course, and across the state where you may go if it's a financial restriction and it's a hardship for you to pay for an attorney's services. Contact the state lawyer referral service with the Wisconsin State Bar and talk with them about resources available in your area for legal assistance that may be at a discount or entirely free. Yes, you could create your own will. Your question, I think, at the beginning was, you know, how do you know if you're of sound mind? If you're working with an attorney, then as I mentioned, that attorney will assess your capacity when he or she sits down with you to create your plan. And, you know, I mentioned you need to have some understanding of what your assets are. You know, even if you're not the one who is maybe, you know, controlling your bank account, paying your bills, et cetera, as long as you generally know, you know, I don't have $500,000. I've got $5,000 or, you know, and then furthermore, as long as you can indicate who you wish to receive your assets when you pass away, that's really what you need in the moment. So it's a somewhat low threshold.
Really. We're spending the hour on wills and estate planning with attorney Chantel Ringy. What lessons did you learn about drafting your will that you can pass on to others? What has been a good option for your family as you talk about this document? Be part of this conversation, 800-642-1234. We'll pick this up with Chantel Ringy after a news update. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. We're discussing wills here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Governor Evers unveiled a sweeping COVID relief bill yesterday. One aspect of the bill would allow notaries to perform online notarization of estate planning documents like wills and trusts through the end of next year. This would make it possible for people who want to do estate planning during the pandemic to do it remotely. Have you been trying to complete your will or legal documents in these times? What have you encountered? Join in 800-642-1234. We have Chantel Ringy for the hour. She's an attorney in Madison and stays with us. We heard from Terry, called from Middleton, couldn't stay with us, Chantel, but Terry says they have some stock that's in their name, and the stock is also in the name of their child, but they want to know how to change it to include all of their children's names. How would Terry go about that?
Yeah, so when they say that they have stock that's titled in the name of their child, and I'm assuming we're speaking about a minor child, I'm wondering if they mean they've got the child named as the beneficiary or the, you know, payable on death recipient, because most financial institutions will not title an asset, an account, including stocks, in the name of a child. Maybe it's passed to a child and they haven't done anything to retitle it. To change the beneficiary designation, if you want to add your other children, you would reach out either directly to the company in which you hold the shares, if they're directly held with the company. Otherwise, if they have, you know, an agent like ComputerShare that maybe does their administration for them, reach out to ComputerShare. I'm assuming they're getting some kind of a statement that would include a phone number that they could call and make the request, or essentially a blank beneficiary designation form.
Yeah.
And they could update that. Now, my next piece of advice would be don't name minor children to directly receive assets, because in the event they do end up receiving them while they're still a minor, if they, you know, chances are they're going to be enough that whoever's managing those assets for them would need to petition the court to be appointed with some authority to claim those assets on behalf of the minor. So we often use trusts within a will, like a subtrust that's kind of a contingent trust that would only come into fruition if the creator of the will happened to pass before that child is of the age at which they could manage those assets themselves. And so within that trust, you're appointing someone, you know, the trustee, to administer those assets for the young beneficiary until they reach an age at which you hope they're going to be capable of managing those assets. And sometimes for many of my clients, it's not, oh, you know, when my child turns 18, that's when I'm going to feel like
18 really is not the magic number all the time.
18 is not the magic number for many. For many people, I don't know what you were like when you were 18, but you know, I don't think I would have managed a chunk of money well at that age. So, you know, that's the reason why many of my clients do like the idea of establishing sort of this latent contingent trust within their will, or if they've got a revocable trust, then within their revocable trust document that says, while Junior is under the age of 25, their share of my estate is going to go to the Jenny Junior Trust that's going to be administered by Uncle Bill. And, you know, Uncle Bill, meanwhile, has the ability to make distributions to benefit the child, you know, pay for living expenses if necessary, or things related to education or health, et cetera, usually very flexible terms. And then when the child reaches that set age, that breaking age, if there's anything left in the trust at that point in time, then they get it outright. And hopefully, again, you know, by that time, they're equipped to manage it well.
Well, let's bring in Russ now, who's joining us from Stoughton. Hi, Russ. What is your question?
Hi. I moved to Wisconsin about 14 years ago from Illinois. And my wife had passed, and I wanted to write a new will based on new possessions and home and everything. And I have two grown married sons in Illinois. And when I talked to this lawyer, which was recommended by the pastor from my church, I was told that now that I live in Wisconsin, that I have to have my executor also had to live in Wisconsin. So I was forced to make my niece, who lived in Wisconsin up till now, but now her and her husband are moving to Florida. So I guess am I going to need a new executor that lives in Wisconsin, or did I get bad information, and can I name my oldest son in Illinois as executor?
Good question. Yes, you can name your son. And my general recommendation is name the person who you think is going to do the best job, regardless of where they live. You can have an out-of-state personal representative. In Dane County, at least, though, the court will require that out-of-state fiduciary to establish a bond, to purchase a bond, which many people aren't really familiar with what is a bond. But there are companies that they're in the business of selling essentially an insurance policy to that out-of-state resident that gives some guarantee to the beneficiaries, and they may be one of the beneficiaries, but that he or she is not going to abscond with the assets of the estate. And our court here in the county requires that, and I'm not sure that all county courts in the state require that, but they require that because they feel that they have, you know, little jurisdiction over an out-of-state agent who is potentially managing a lot of wealth for third parties. And so at least the insurance policy, which is usually pegged somehow to the value of the estate that they're managing, gives them some assurance that if things go south, there's some recovery yet for the other beneficiaries to receive. But yes, you absolutely can have an out-of-state personal representative.
Russ, thank you for that question. We're talking about wills, and attorney Chantel Ringy is our guide and attorney in Madison. What questions do you have about estate planning? What has the process been like for you? Do you have a child with special needs and you're not sure how to plan for a future? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Chantel, we heard from Tim in Luck, called in, couldn't stay with us. And Tim wants to bring up that there's also a document called transfer on death deed or document allowing where at least real estate can be set up. And it costs about $300 to $400, stops property from going into probate. Tim set this up for Tim's mother-in-law. Can you talk to us a little bit about this document?
Yes, it's a designation of TOD beneficiary. TOD standing for transfer on death. And it is a, you know, a state form, a standard form, but it's very much like a deed. And so you should work with an attorney to create it. And I gather that's why he quoted that it costs $300 to $400, because really the only other underlying expense associated with creating a TOD for your property, your real estate, is the $30 fee that the Register of Deeds is going to charge you to record it. But basically, it's one of my favorite things because it helps you avoid probate often, because one of the things that notoriously triggers a probate or a need for a probate is real estate. So the family home, when maybe the second spouse passes away and there's no one else on the deed. Well, a designation of TOD beneficiary is kind of like a beneficiary designation for that real estate. And so if your situation is simple enough that you've got individuals who are adults with capacity, you know, no disabilities to worry about, and you can just name them as outright beneficiaries on that TOD form, that can work wonderfully well, and it can be very seamless in the event. Basically, what it is you record it with the Register of Deeds. It doesn't convey any current interest in the property, so it doesn't give those beneficiaries any ownership in your home. And if you sell your property, it obviously no longer controls. But in the event of your passing, the property would pass without the need for probate to the named beneficiaries. And so, you know, unless you have minor kids or, again, individuals that you'd want their interest to transfer to a trust, maybe you'd want to name a trust in that case. But yeah, it is a pretty slick document that I make use of a lot in my office.
Let's bring in Jim in Cedarburg with a question. Hi, Jim. Go ahead.
Good morning. Thank you. I want to know if I can change the ownership of a investment account. My father and I both are on a joint tenancy. He has been deemed incapacitated for since last year, but it's in his name as far as taxes are concerned. Can I switch that now? I'm POA.
Yeah, so your power of attorney on the account, but not the co-owner, it sounds like.
I am joint. It's a joint tenancy account.
Yeah, so if it's a joint account, just like if two spouses held an account jointly, one of them can go to the bank and retitle it. So if it's set up that way, then the financial institution should permit you to do that. I guess, you know, you might want to think through why you would do that. You know, if it really is his property, then you want to take care that it's used for his benefit, obviously, particularly if he may have a need for something like long-term care Medicaid benefits. You don't want Medicaid to view that change in title as a divestment of assets on his part, which might prevent him from qualifying for benefits that he may otherwise need.
Chantel Ringy, our guide to transferring assets and drafting a will. Have you thought about difficult questions like who would take care of your children? Who is going to take care of your pets? What about your digital life? Have you thought about your bank accounts, your Twitter, your photo storage, what's on your computer? Still time to talk, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Chantel Ringy here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Let's get back to our conversation with attorney Chantel Ringy about drafting a will. Surveys estimate that more than half of Americans don't have one. Let's bring in Kurt in Brownsville with a question. Hi, Kurt. Go ahead.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to find out, my wife and I are both in our 60s, and we want to set up a will, you know, leaving everything to our daughter. I just wondering, do we need to set up separate wills, or can we just make out one will for both of us? I'm not really sure on that.
Yeah, that's a good question. So, Kurt, what you would want is to have separate wills because, well, A, you don't know who's going to pass first, and presumably when one of you passes away and the other is surviving, you're going to want whatever interest that deceased spouse held in assets to pass not to your daughter, but to your surviving spouse. And so usually that's the way it's set up, if that's your preference. And then moreover, in that case, maybe the surviving spouse would be the one to kind of be nominated as the personal representative to handle any loose ends that may need to be tended to when the first spouse passes away. And then each of your wills would say, if you're the surviving spouse, then when you pass, as you're indicating as your wish, then your daughter would receive what remains. And so in Wisconsin, though, if you were to do what we were talking about earlier, with the revocable trust plan, if you were to establish a plan that was designed to avoid probate, then you would likely have a joint trust. So in other words, the two of you would still have separate, sort of, as I mentioned, abbreviated wills, but you'd have a joint trust instrument. And so I've never prepared joint wills. I think maybe you can, but I wouldn't.
Yeah.
But you can have a joint trust in Wisconsin, and that's typically the type of revocable trust that married persons in Wisconsin have, is one common joint trust instrument. Again, that's designed for avoiding probate.
I would imagine that your clients who come to you, if they have children, they'll want to know, should they treat them differently in their will? I mean, some of a child may have greater financial burdens than another child, or maybe a child has special needs. What do you advise there?
Yeah. I think from time to time, particularly when a client has a loved one with special needs, sometimes I hear from them, well, I'm just not going to leave them anything, you know, because it would be problematic from the perspective of whatever, you know, public benefits they may otherwise be eligible for, or they wouldn't know how to manage it. And what oftentimes I find those clients who think that's their only option in those cases, when they learn that they could quite easily establish the framework for a trust for their benefit, a special needs trust for their loved one, and direct their share to that trust document or framework, so that they've got a trustee to manage it. And if it's drafted properly, there are federal and state laws in place that will disregard the assets in that special needs trust for purposes of that beneficiary's financial eligibility for means-tested public benefits like Medicaid or Social Security SSI. So that's definitely an option that I like to make sure my clients are aware of when they're debating, particularly in the context of they've got a special needs beneficiary. What do I leave to them? Do I leave anything?
Yeah. You know, we're in our last few moments here, and there is just a whole lot of financial advice out there in this area. What is the best tip you can leave us with when it comes to wills and planning for the future?
We haven't really talked too much about powers of attorney, but that's kind of the other piece of a more comprehensive estate plan. And of course, those are relevant while you're living, and that can be very important. So even if you don't have much of an estate to speak of, or whether you do or not, it's very important that you, and very simple oftentimes, that you take some steps to plan for your own incapacity while living. And the way that you do that primarily would be with a healthcare power of attorney, and a financial power of attorney. Those are kind of the two documents that I highly recommend everyone have. Once you turn 18, you know, set those up. They're quite simple to execute.
Chantel, thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah. Yes, my pleasure. Thank you so much for having me. It's been great.
Chantel Ringy, partner at Hale Glowacki, a Madison law firm working in the area of estate planning, elder law, and special needs planning. And now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Carl Christensen with a story about deer hunting just ahead of the opening of gun season this weekend.
For many Wisconsinites, deer hunting is more than just a seasonal hobby. It's an opportunity to slow things down for a bit and take some time to enjoy the outdoors with friends and family. Ron Weber shares a story about how every fall, a humble dwelling in the Wisconsin Northwoods is transformed from a cabin to deer camp.
Most of the year, we simply call it the cabin. A small two-bedroom retreat with a modest kitchen, living room, and a bathroom slightly smaller than the average ice fishing shanty. Nestled on Eagle Point along the crooked shores of Lake Namakagan in Bayfield County, It is a favorite destination any time of the year. But for 9 days each November, it becomes something much more. It becomes Deer Camp. Deer Camp actually has its genesis about a month earlier. As the colorful tapestry of October leaves fall to the ground, it signals the beginning. Though there are numerous other activities to fill the autumn days, the seeds of Deer Camp have sprouted. Just an inkling at first, which can be satisfied by taking a look at a deer rifle or rummaging through hunting gear. The feeling continues to grow as the days shorten and the steely cold November landscape takes hold. Warm Indian summer days offer only a brief respite. By the second week of November, the urge has now become so great that it can be satisfied only by pulling out the blaze orange clothing that have been waiting patiently to reappear since last season. It is inspected and hung outside to air out. Drive anywhere in Wisconsin the week before deer season, and you will see orange dotting backyards like so many pumpkins. Knives, flashlights, ropes, compasses, and assorted other equipment are checked and rechecked. Deer rifles are sighted in, cleaned and oiled. Just days away now, the anticipation is almost unbearable. I feel a primal pull towards the cabin. I like to get there Thursday or early Friday before opening day so I can watch the transformation. There alone, it is still the cabin, but as others drift in one or two at a time, it magically becomes Deer Camp. Food, clothing, guns, and other assorted gear quickly fill every corner. The camp is also now filled with jokes and laughter, stories of past hits and misses, and a most special brand of camaraderie. Each of us stakes out our piece of real estate to hang clothes and stow gear for the coming season. Deer Camp is more than a place, it is a unique state of mind and being. For the next week and a half, life is reduced to its simplest terms. Planning the next day's hunt or checking the coming weather are the biggest concerns. If only for this short time, all other worries and responsibilities seem to fade, covered up by, hopefully, some fresh snow. If lucky enough to have a camp in a poor service area, even smartphones and other devices can be put at bay. A good deer hunter is an eternal optimist. Whatever did or didn't come down the trail today, there is always tomorrow and a new chance. The chances and the people who share them is what Deer Camp is all about. All too soon, though, there are no more tomorrows. As the season draws to a close, those who have stayed on all season begin packing up their gear. On the last day, vehicles are loaded, some last-minute pictures are taken, and reluctant goodbyes are said. Making a last check of the place, with a sense of melancholy, I realize Deer Camp is gone, and it is simply the cabin again. Until next November.
Ron Weber is an author and forester who lives in Weyerhaeuser. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Want to make sure you catch every Wisconsin Life story? Subscribe to our podcast feed, wherever you get your podcasts. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Carl Christensen.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network.